Okay. Thanks for having me, comrades. So Karl Marx was a revolutionary his whole mature life. He committed himself to the overthrow of capitalism, was for workers' revolution, and a fundamental transformation of society that could liberate humanity. He supported every transformation of society. He supported every emancipatory cause during his lifetime, from the European uprisings of 1848 through the American Civil War, Polish and Irish national independence, Indian and Algerian anti-colonialism. Academics often depoliticize Marx and omit his revolutionary life. They say that he was just a scholar. These academics have prejudices against revolutionary politics, and therefore they say that while Marx may have had a few dreams about a better world, of a more welfare-style capitalism, by old age he gave up on any utopian nonsense about revolutionary politics and the change of society. These people are dead wrong. These arguments do a profound disservice to Marx, and so I want to talk today about Marx's life and his politics and underline the revolutionary character of this. Throughout this talk, I want you to keep in mind one quote from Friedrich Engels, Marx's closest collaborator, who, after Marx's death, wrote the following: "Not until the times get somewhat more turbulent shall we really be aware of what we have lost in Marx. At a revolutionary juncture, his judgment was virtually infallible." Now, Marx didn't develop an infallible revolutionary judgment by closing himself away in the British Museum, in an ivory tower, divorced from the working class and its struggles and the conditions of life. Marx developed revolutionary judgment by being an activist locked into the key struggles of his time. In fact, Marx cut his teeth in polemic against the very armchair socialists that many academics today want to make out of him. And throughout his life, he always gave them a thrashing when it was necessary. In this talk, I'm going to go over or divide Marx's life into three main periods: the 1848 revolution or uprisings, his leadership of the First International, and finally, the late years of the 1870s before his death in 1883, after the collapse of the Paris Commune. A few brief words about each of these three periods is necessary. Marx was active as an editor and party builder throughout the 1848 revolutions, which swept across France, the German Confederation, and the Austrian Empire and Italy. Throughout the First International, Marx developed a revolutionary perspective in relation to the British working class movement of the 1860s and the 1870s, early 1870s. In his last years, after the defeat of the Paris Commune and the collapse of the First International, Marx continued to intervene into the early workers' movement in Germany and in France, but as well as the oppositional movement in Russia that was confronting the Tsar. I'll go into these three moments of his life, but it's important to see that Marx is special for another reason. He's special for anyone that wants to change the world and understand it, because he was one of those rare breeds in history who tried to combine theory and practice. Philosophers of his generation had only interpreted the world, yet Marx set out to change it. To change the world, two things were necessary: revolutionary theory and revolutionary practice. Marx's whole life was committed to a form of science that could be integrated into revolutionary politics. He was neither an armchair socialist nor a mindless activist, his form of science, however, being inspired by the German tradition he came from, of which Hegel was the principal influence. This form of science really was about the criticism of existing conditions of society and the prevailing ideas, and Marx, through this critique, set out to overthrow this situation. This means that Marx eventually tried to develop a scientific theory of the way in which, you know, capitalism exploits workers. And two implications follow from this. First, that when looking at Marx's life, we have to pay attention, you know, in Marx's spirit, to the requirements of scientific discovery that he himself put forward, because good intentions alone do not suffice to overthrow capitalism. But secondly, Marx's own political practice, revolutionary activism, has to be understood in relation to his scientific work. And it is not reduced to it, but it gives us a better sense of what he was doing. And that's very important in talking about his life. There's a difficulty, however, that I had in presenting this talk. Do you follow Marx's life forwards or backwards? Now, I want to show that that revolutionary politics was key to Marx's life. But you can do this by either starting from the beginning of his life and move forwards, or from the end and moving backwards. And most people begin by saying, you know, beginning from the beginning and saying Marx was a liberal democrat early on, a Hegelian, then became a communist when he discovered the working class and revolution at about 1843 and 44, when he realized that Germany needed a revolution instead of reforms to win democracy. This is a fine story and it's true, and there are many good books about it. But in a certain sense, it is only by reading Marx's life and politics backwards from the 1880s that we can really understand the depth of what it meant to commit to working class struggle and revolution, because to begin with Marx's late life is to begin with a whole wealth of experience, a whole set of developed politics that condense in nearly 40 years of commitment to working class self-emancipation. Once Marx realized the centrality of working class self-emancipation to history and society and politics, it opened up a whole new terrain for the very idea of political activism, commitment, politics. It required the intervention into mass struggles and debates that took place within them. Marx broke with all the different forms of elitist, sectarian, conspiratorial organizing that had dominated the revolutionary movement since the French Revolution onwards. The discovery of the working class opened the door to a politics capable of learning from the experience of mass struggle that could draw on the experience of class struggle and grasp the dynamics of capitalism as a whole. Because Marx saw mass struggle as being key to history, he had to learn the history of the workers' movement and the oppressed, and be part of the practical struggles of this movement and these movements themselves. Marx continued, therefore, to learn throughout his whole life, precisely because of his commitment to the principle of class struggle. It was not at all reductive. Marx was a political materialist, and throughout his life, he wrote for American, English, and German papers, observing, reading, and analyzing all the events of contemporary world history. This prolonged labor provided Marx the chance to apply, to verify, and revise his materialist inquiry into the world around him. And owing to this whole process of materialist observation and theoretical effort, within which revolutionary politics played a crucial role, he came to the conclusions that matter today. So there's a rationale, therefore, to start the talk with the end of Marx's political life, right from 1883 backwards. However, I'm not going to do that, but I want you to keep in mind that sense of open political development, Marx's learning process, because it is one of the wonderful things about revolutionary politics is that you continue to learn about the world around you because you want to change it. The two go hand in hand. So to reiterate, I'm going to cover Marx's attempt to build working class politics over the course of the 1840s. And throughout the 1848 uprisings, then his role on the General Council of the First International, and finally the late years after the collapse of the First International. By the mid-1840s, Marx had come to his revolutionary breakthrough alongside Engels of seeing the working class as the force that could transform society and change the world. Marx and Engels, based on this viewpoint, the communist viewpoint, tried to build revolutionary organizations. They wanted to win the most militant artisans and workers of Europe to, at the time, to communist politics. To do so, they had to build an organization. So between, you know, discovering the class struggle materialism in a set of manuscripts called the German Ideology and the European Revolutionary Uprisings of 1848, Marx and Engels tried to build and prepare. They were political activists. In February 1846, Marx and Engels set up the Communist Correspondence Committees based then in Brussels, which was at the time had the most liberal constitution across Europe. The project was to clarify communist ideas, to win over the French, German, Belgian, and English workers to revolutionary communism and the fight for democracy. Marx and Engels had to cut through and defend revolutionary communism against the many rivals and tendencies among workers, from utopian socialists who built their blueprints for the future, to the socialist religions that were, you know, cropping up everywhere, who were extremely sectarian and waiting for the Messiah, effectively. They polemicized against the followers of Proudhon in France, who thought that the revolution wasn't the road forward for social development. And even, you know, they polemicized against currents that looked towards class harmony and love, the true socialists, which was strong in Germany at the time. Well, against all these tendencies, Marx and Engels said, classes are irreconcilable. The exploitation of workers by capital cannot be overcome through some kind of love-in, some kind of utopian scheme, by some kind of newfound harmony, leaving class society in place. Workers must struggle in a revolutionary manner to seize power away from the bourgeoisie, and they must win the battle of democracy in society at large. If it had not have been for their detailed political work, their organizational work as activists, Marx and Engels would never have written the Communist Manifesto, which was a party publication of the Communist League that had recently formed before they wrote it. Marx eagerly awaited the 1848 revolutions. And shortly before the outbreak of the revolution itself, the Communist Manifesto was published, and it declared war on bourgeois society while expecting a bourgeois democratic revolution in Germany. Very soon, the insurrection that broke out in France spread to Germany, to Austria, and Marx was arrested and chased out of Brussels. He was a subversive threat. He went to Paris and finally made his way to the Rhineland. Marx chose the Rhineland in Germany because it was an industrial stronghold of the country, of the German Confederation, with a substantial number of wage workers. And he hoped it would be a place where he could have the most freedom to agitate and propagandize amongst workers and the democratic opposition. Marx and Engels set up the revolutionary newspaper, the Neue Rheinische Zeitung. Their paper was an organ of democracy, the most incisive revolutionary paper in Germany throughout the revolution. It was the go-to if you wanted to know what was happening and what the turning points were. It was putting into practice the Communist Manifesto's declaration that the communists had to win the battle for democracy. And this is a truly fascinating moment in Marx's life. Marx drew many conclusions from the 1848 revolutions. Of course, they went down to defeat, and his conclusions remain relevant today about why the revolution went down to defeat. The revolutions were an expression, and this is a point I'd like to underline. They were an expression of a critical historical transition taking place over the course of the 19th century. That is, the passing of the French, the European bourgeois revolutions, the English Civil War, and the Great French Revolution, which had crushed the organized power of European feudalism over to a working class revolution against capital and its state. Marx's perspectives throughout the revolution itself, from the way in which he built the revolutionary newspaper as an organ of democracy, to the way in which he related to the liberal bourgeois and proletarian forces, the working class forces, this all reflected the transition from a classical European bourgeois revolution to an emergent working class revolution. It was the most significant turning point of the 19th century, or one of the most significant turning points of the 19th century. And Marx participated fully within it. The transition itself was best captured in the June Days uprising of French workers in 1848. Parisian workers rose up in revolt with barricades and took over parts of the city for days. It was the signal that a new form of a revolution was on the agenda, a working class revolution. And we have to keep in mind the significance of this and the fact that before this moment, the French Revolution was the reference point for revolutionary politics at the time. Marx himself was obsessed with the lessons of the French Revolution. He even wanted to write a book about it in the 1840s. The French Revolution was an example Marx had if he wanted to come to terms with the dynamics of revolutionary struggle. But it was a bourgeois revolution, and referring to it meant he expected more from the liberal bourgeoisie, and for a certain period, he downplayed the independent role of working class political struggle. But as the revolutionary struggle of 1848 unfolded, and it was very clear that the liberal bourgeoisie, you know, they were cowards, they were spineless in the face of the old regime, and they feared a working class movement that threatened their interests, their property, their power, their authority. The bourgeoisie never recovered from the June uprising of 1848 and the similar risings that hit the German-speaking countries. It was clear at that time then that the center of gravity for politics throughout the 1848 revolutions was moving more and more towards independent working class struggle. More, if you, in a sense, in accord with what Marx and Engels had discovered in the mid-1840s, the centrality of the working class. Marx's own politics shifted, as did the line of the revolutionary paper, and yet the revolution was defeated. Marx became stateless and was forced to seek refuge in London. If Marx was captured by the counter-revolution, I think this is something to keep in mind when people want to portray him as just a scholar. He probably would have been imprisoned or even executed like many others who went against the state. But as I said earlier, Marx's materialist orientation required that he learn from the class struggle, which is such, you know, is such a condensed and complex process in periods of revolutionary turbulence like 1848. This is precisely what he and Engels did after the defeat. They reflected on the reasons for their defeat in internal circulars for the Communist League, the group they were still involved with, in 1850. Then Marx wrote the famous 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, and Engels wrote his Revolution and Counter-Revolution in Germany, all of which summarized the lessons of this incredible period of struggle. These works are masterclasses in grasping the dynamics of class struggles and their political expressions, and they're very much worth the time and effort to read. Three fundamental lessons came out of the collection of texts, which remain relevant, I think, to today's world. In fact, they are essential lessons for anybody on the left today, anybody that wants to get involved with socialist politics. The first lesson is that unlike the bourgeois revolutions that had all perfected the state machinery, because the state machinery was in the hands of a minority, an exploiting class, and they used the state machinery to subjugate workers. In contrast to this, a workers' revolution is called upon to smash this state and liberate society and liberate the exploited from society through smashing the state. And this actually was a true innovation for politics that should not go unnoticed. The second lesson Marx drew from the experience of the 1848 defeat was about the need for working class political independence. The working class had to build its own organizations in its own interests and wage a concerted political struggle against all social layers, whether they're absolutist, feudal, through the capitalists, you know, all these social layers that are hostile to working class liberation. The third lesson that Marx arrived at was that workers can begin, or must begin, in a sense, in a revolutionary period, to build their own organs of power, able to rival the bureaucratic state machine. Marx and Engels say this very clearly in the 1850 March address, and I quote, they write, "Alongside the official governments, they, the workers, must establish their own revolutionary workers' governments, whether in the form of municipal committees or municipal councils, or in the form of workers' clubs or workers' committees, so that the bourgeois democratic governments not only immediately lose the support of the workers, but from the outset see themselves supervised and threatened by the authorities backed up by the whole mass of the workers." Aside from the revolutionary dynamics of 1848, and here Marx and Engels are talking about a concept of dual power, of workers' power, in a sense, you know, of an organized working class power that rivals the officially existing government. This can be made sense of in Marx's writings before and after the 1848 revolutions. See, in the lead up to the revolutions, Marx's writings were directed towards the emergence of a politics of the oppressed, or thinking this through, that could prepare the way for a necessary withering away of the state as a separate body. Now, the Paris Commune gave dual power a concretized historical form with the uprisings of workers. But dual power was also a fact of the American Civil War, albeit in a different form, owing to the class nature of that revolution. Nevertheless, the important point to underline is that Marx saw dual power as a fact of revolutionary politics. These lessons of the need to smash the bourgeois bureaucratic state, dual power, and working class independence fit together in a coherent and systematic whole of revolutionary politics in Marx. In fact, each element comes together into Marx's major contribution to political thought, i.e. the concept of the idea that to fight for of working class power, otherwise known as the dictatorship of the proletariat, but synonymous. These lessons were essential to Marx's politics, even though his politics cannot be reduced simply to each of them. Now, I'm going to go over to Marx's role on the General Council of the First International, founded in London in 1864. This was the most extended period in which Marx was active as a political leader. It was not the densest period of his political activism, since that role, you know, his role in the 1848 revolutions definitely takes that prize, because revolutionary time is always more condensed or dense, or thicker, if you wish. But Marx's leadership in the First International from 1864 to 1872 was his most extended, and it was his most quite successful period of political activity. Marx did not invent the First International, but he was invited as a distinguished exile and friend of the people to participate early on in the foundation of the organization. Within a year, however, of the First International's foundation, Marx had become the de facto leader of it, for he combined a far-reaching intellectual framework that was materialistically grounded and based firmly on class struggle politics. And he combined this with an attention to organizational detail and day-to-day politics. Remember that Marx was at this time also editing Volume 1 of Capital and writing Volume 3 of Capital, which were, you know, and Volume 1 being published in 1867. So we have here an example, an excellent example of the interrelation between revolutionary theory, or a scientific critique of capitalism, and then political activism, and the two very much interleave. Marx was a defender of internationalism, hence obviously the name of the organization, but as the Communist Manifesto slogan "For the workers of the world to unite" proclaimed, internationalism was a decisive political question for the workers' movement. And Marx was an internationalist, it must be said, not only in politics, but also in theory, because his work on Capital was about understanding capitalism as a world system, not just capitalism in Britain. If we take a little look at the history of internationalism in the labor movement, reaching back to the French Revolution, I think that at least in Britain, internationalism was stifled during the Revolutionary and the Napoleonic Wars. And, you know, there was a reform agitation between 1792 and 1796, inspired by the revolutionary ideal of equality, égalité, the ideas of Tom Paine and the rights of man, the prospects of a democracy of laborers. All of this sent chills down the spines of property and authority. And so they passed the Combination Acts in 1799-1800, persecuting the labor movement. But as E.P. Thompson showed in an excellent book about the English working class, the legacy of the reform agitation lived on in the 1840s in the body of the Chartists and their fraternal Democrats, who were actually in contact with Marx and Engels and their communist correspondence committees in Brussels that I mentioned earlier. Now, of course, there was a great difference between internationalism in the 1840s and the First International. Marx's internationalism in the 1840s involved the correspondence committees that could keep ideas flowing between France, Belgium, Germany, and England in the lead up to the foundation of the Communist League and the revolutionary wave of 1848. But it was not an international organization that could intervene when workers were on strike, strikers were killed, or scabs were being brought in from across Europe, and they had to stop this importation to win the strikes. The international played, therefore, a vital role. Internationalism was key to winning class struggles. And the First International, therefore, you know, it was the first association that grouped together working class organizations from across Europe. There were six arguably political reasons for the formation of the First International. You know, these things are the products of history, political contexts, conjunctures. The London building workers, had a series of strikes from 1859 to 1862, and they were demanding the 9-hour day. The Italian Risorgimento of 1859-64 was very well respected amongst the London labor movement. Of course, you had the American Civil War, where the Whig and Tory establishment in England supported the Southern slaveholders. You know, while the workers' movement rallied behind the abolition of slavery and the emancipation of slaves. The Polish insurrection of January 1863, then the rebirth, recovery and development of the French workers' movement after Napoleon III's coup d'etat. And in England itself, there was, you know, a further revival of the struggle for the workers' franchise, with demonstrations leading up to the founding meeting of the First International on September 28, 1864 at St. Martin's Hall. But as I said earlier, Marx had drawn the lessons from the 1848 defeat, two of which were that the bourgeois state needs to be smashed and that workers need their own independent political party to fight for their own objectives. Marx's perspective for the First International incorporated these lessons. And in this sense, the very foundation of Marx's vision of the First International was class struggle, i.e. no harmony with bourgeois society and the bosses. And the International was to prepare the political grounds for revolutionary struggle. As Marx wrote to Engels in 1867 after the Lausanne Congress, he said, "In the next revolution, we will have this powerful engine in our hands." Now, as it turns out, the revolution took place in Paris with the Commune, not in London. And that was somewhat unfortunate in a sense for the International. But the point is that the First International's aim was the economic emancipation of the working class through the conquest of political power. This was a principle of working class self-emancipation. And the International gave the greatest play to the local struggles and independence. It had a comprehensive sense of working class activity and struggle. And Marx fought for this kind of expansive sense of working class struggle. And his concept of class struggle politics, therefore, was not restricted. But, you know, this expansiveness flowed from the very principle of working class self-emancipation. And you can see the makeup of the First International by looking at the list of affiliated societies. From a report dated 1867, you can read who affiliated the previous year, and it's fascinating. And only in England, however. The London Basket Makers Society, the Block Printers of Lancashire, the London Coach Builders, the Elastic Web Weavers, the United Excavators, the French Polishers, the Organ Builders, the Pattern Drawers and the Block Cutters, the Carpenters and Joiners Executive, the United Society of Journeymen, and the National Reform League, the last of which was a political organization, not a trade. All these affiliations were added to the bricklayers, the cabinet makers, the bookbinders, cigar makers, shoemakers, ribbon weavers, West End ladies, boot makers, and the London operative tailors. The First International was the strongest in the London building trades. And two facts about the International spring to the eye. The first is the centrality of strikes, and the second is the political questions it debated and intervened into. The strike support was key to Marx and the International. Some of the key struggles were those of the London tailors, the Belgian miners, the French bronze workers who were faced with lockouts, and the lockout of the Geneva building workers, and then the Paris iron molders strike. The International helped or intervened into many of these struggles that won a lot of prestige and respect. Marx saw strikes as a training ground in the class struggle. Without strikes, there's no dynamic of working class self-emancipation. It's not really that conceivable. But politically, you know, the emphasis on strikes didn't neglect politics. There was a whole range of issues that Marx took seriously, from the democratic agitation in England to the Irish struggles and black liberation, Polish national independence, opposition to racism and anti-migrant sentiment in the English working class, and finally the question of war. When the Franco-Prussian War broke out in 1870, one of the reasons for the Paris Commune uprising, Marx was instrumental in figuring out an attitude to take towards it. That was principled, that was internationalist, that was based on the needs of the working class. Paying attention to Marx's activism in the First International also illuminates different parts of Capital. It politicizes certain scientific aspects of the book. There are many examples of this politicization, but I'll take one. Marx's debates over strikes for higher wages. Not everyone in the First International supported wage increases through strikes. One member of the General Council, the leadership body of the organization of the International, John Weston, argued that it was pointless for workers to go on strike for higher wages. Marx argued against this, and he did so, you know, with Capital forming a lot of his material. Marx's Capital shows, in a scientific way, that there is domination and exploitation at the heart of capitalist society, and that the relationship between bosses and workers, and in this relationship, workers strike for better conditions from raised wages through the working day, were the foundations of any movement to overthrow this exploitation. So anybody opposing strikes and giving it a theoretical justification is actually, you know, against one of the most powerful means with which you can win the struggle for socialism. So the brilliant thing about reading Marx is that you always find theoretical and political value from his works. You read his opinions and you see, you know, a vivid writing that is full of passion, that is with a great interest in all the most important historical and ideological trends of his time. And when, for instance, you turn to Marx's defense of the Paris Commune, the heroic communards that rose up and were crushed by Versailles, you know, when you read his letters of the time, you realize that you have your eyes on the words of a great thinker, when the masses rose, wanted to march with them, to learn with them in the process of struggle. Marx valued, above all else, the fact that the working class, heroically and with the greatest self-sacrifice, took the initiative in making world history. And for Marx, world history can only be understood from the standpoint of those who make it. That is, you know, one of the major reasons for his activism. Now I'm going to come to the late Marx, and I'm probably running out of time, but I hope not. Now, you know, Marx's final decade after the collapse of the commune and the cessation of the international in the 1870s up to his death in 1883, these years were extremely creative. And there's no question of him giving up on revolutionary politics or of having fallen into some kind of sad dogmatic muddle. Many people neglect these late years, and it's unfortunate. We're actually, right now, learning so much about these late years because of the excellent work people are doing in relation to the Marx and Engels completed works, which is being put together as we speak. It's true that Marx was less active in an immediate day-to-day sense, political sense. But the last years of his life are a reservoir of experience, of observation, of authentic political thought. These years were characterized by a renewed focus on his scientific work. For instance, he was drafting volume 2 of Capital again, or redrafting it. He was editing the French edition of Capital, which had a scientific value, independent of the original. And he followed the development of capitalism in the United States while also engaging with the leaders of the French and German socialist parties, as well as the developing Russian revolutionary tradition. It's important to pay attention to just how creative Marx was in late life, how politically astute he remained, and how he continued to learn in new fields of research. Two political interventions, however, of the late Marx were extremely important, and I want to talk about these two. The Critique of the Goethe Program of 1879 and the introduction to the program of the French Workers' Party. These documents reflect the political lessons in many ways that Marx drew from the Paris Commune. They also mark the beginnings of the European Socialist Parties that would come to play a prominent role in the Second International. The two documents are uneven, of course, because Marx himself didn't publish but shelved the Critique of the Goethe Program, and Engels only managed to have it published years later because the reformist leadership of the SPD wanted to suppress it, to suppress Marx's opinion, while Marx's French program was adopted. But I just want to make it one point about Marx's Critique of the Goethe Program, specifically what he said about individual liberation. Though there are many things to be said about this remarkable text outside of this point, Marx fought for the full liberation of the individual. And this was tied to the transformation of society as a whole. Capitalism stunts human beings, communism liberates them. And Marx's sense of liberation was fundamentally about the all-round development of individuals, where the liberation of one is the condition for the liberation of all, because a society liberated from capitalism functions around the most creative and cooperative faculties of life itself. Communism is fundamentally, and was for Marx, about exploring the emancipatory side of what humanity is capable of. That's what makes communism, as a movement that abolishes the present state of things, such an exhilarating set of politics. And Marx retained this sense of human liberation into old age. He didn't waver on it. And in fact, I'd say he deepened it. If we turn to Marx's introduction to the program of the French Workers' Party, it says all that needs to be said and more. The emancipation of the class of producers, i.e. workers, is universal, involving all human beings without distinction of race or sex. This ran completely against the colonialist, racist, and male chauvinist trends of bourgeois politics in France at the time, as well as their influence within the workers' movement itself. For instance, many anarchists and Proudhonists were not for women's emancipation, and they were against women's participation in trade unions and politics and the workplace in some instances. Marx was far in advance of all of these backwards attitudes that persisted into the 20th century amongst many anarchists and the Stalinists. But secondly, Marx clarified that the emancipation for all human beings can only come about when workers are free. For workers to be free, they need to be in possession of the means of production. And the further capitalism and industry develop, the more and more that this has to be a collective process. And in France, with its backwards industry, as compared to England at the time, the Proudhonist tradition was often focused on industrial or artisanal workshops being slowly taken over. But for Marx, collective appropriation, and this shows how far-sighted his analysis of capitalism was, it could only come through the revolutionary action of workers, the proletariat, organized into an independent political party. And know well that Marx says in the original French that human emancipation and freedom through the collective appropriation of the means of production can only, that is to say, only come from revolutionary struggle. And with the Paris Commune in the background, what Marx means, I think, is very clear. Finally, I just want to say a few words about what I find so inspiring about Marx's late life. The years between, 1879 or 1880 and 1883, when he was ill and he was caring for his loved ones. If you haven't read Marcello Musto's book on the late Marx about these years, I highly recommend it. In Marx's late life, he did what every old person ought to do, become more radical and open up new horizons of research. Marx lived through defeat after defeat after defeat of the working class movement. But this did not turn him into a cynic. His late years are a testament of the man and his method. He was far from being a dogmatist, and this is what I find so inspiring about the late Marx. Between 1879 and 1882, he studied the newest findings in anthropology, findings in pre-capitalist modes of production, non-European societies, and he further developed the materialist conception of history. He excerpted, for instance, from Morgan's Ancient Society, a very important book at the time, and he was discovering the nature of pre-class societies, absolutely central if we want to understand the historical character of the state and different forms of class and oppression. And he also wrote up a chronological history that ranged from 90 BC up to 1648. And this is a very old man who was about to die, basically. In all of this, this was all on top of the work he did in the 1840s when he read the histories, the classics of political theory, began his critique of political economy. Then through the 1850s, where he really took steps forward in his critique of economics and capitalism. And then the 1860s, where he was focusing on things like ecology, working class conditions, and so on. In Marx's late years, as Marcello Musto wrote, he closely observed also the main events in international politics. As we can see from his letters, he expressed resolute support for the Irish liberation struggles and the populist movement in Russia, and he gave firm support to those struggling against colonialism. So he was opposed straight down the line to British colonialism in India and Egypt, and he was opposed to French colonialism in Algeria. There was absolutely no ambiguity about this. Marx condemned French and British colonialism and stood in full solidarity with those who resisted. And in the late years, Marx also showed a particular interest in Australia and acquired material to challenge those racist opinions who said that there were neither laws nor culture in Aboriginal society. Marx's last years, therefore, were filled with the further exploration of the world around him. In a sense, it's the ultimate proof that looking to the working class and developing a materialist politics opens up a whole life of learning and an ability to react to the key political questions of the time. But given I'm running out of time, I want to end with a final anecdote that I think sums up Marx's life. In 1880, an American journalist made a trip to Europe and he interviewed Marx. After some time spent with Marx, Marx's family, some of his collaborators, talking politics and history, the journalist asked Marx the philosophical question of all philosophical questions. Probably the stupidest thing you could do before someone as cultured as Marx, really. But this question reaches back to ancient Greece, the ancient Greeks. And he said to Marx, what, Dr. Marx, what is the law of being? Talk about an abstract question. Apparently, Marx and his journalists were by the seafront, roaring as it was with waves. Marx turns to Swinton, this journalist, and with one word says the following: struggle. And there you have it. I think if anything else from this talk or from Marx, the answer to the philosophical question of all philosophical questions, struggle. And that's not a bad answer at all. I think it sums up Marx's life as a whole very well. But I'll finish there.